You're listening to episode 8 of the Talentopoly podcast, where we discuss some of the best links posted on talentopoly.com each week. I'm your host, Jared Brown, and I'm joined by
me, Stephen Dixon,
and Brandon Corbin, also known as the Almighty.
So we like to start off with a little segment about what we're drinking. And Stephen, what are you drinking during this podcast?
I'm drinking tea again.
Just tea? I thought you said you were drinking something else tonight.
Oh, no. PG tips.
All right.
Although I wouldn't mind Earl Grey, but no, it's PG tips this time. And I'm drinking it because I have a bit of a headache, so. Boo-hoo.
So you actually.
That's what you get for being British. Burn, man.
So you actually went to sleep and then woke back up for this podcast tonight.
Yeah, well, I went to sleep at about 10 and then woke up at about 11:30, or maybe, yeah, 11:30. So okay. To see if I could shake off the headache, but just it's kind of, yes, it's because I've been working too hard.
And for those who don't know the time difference, right now it is next Thursday at 3 in the morning in England.
We're about a week ahead.
I was up to like 4 a.m. last night and it's not doing good.
Yeah, I was talking to him and trying to convince you to go get some sleep.
I was too busy pushing some pixels.
All right, Brandon, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking ox urine because Stephen didn't admit to it. I am having Edge again today. I was going to shake it up, but I decided, you know what? I'm going to go with the other bottle. And yes, so today it's Edge, and I'm not nearly as crooked as I was last week.
Crooked.
Are you buying that by the case yet?
No, not yet. I won't.
You know you need to. Right. You need to.
No. I need to constantly have to have change. And so my wines will be the same. This is a good one to go back to, but I always have to have something new.
All right. I think I'm committing a cardinal sin here. I'm mixing beer and liquor tonight. So I'm having Absolute Boston and some Lipton tea with it. And I'm also drinking an Oktoberfest from Upland right after I finish that one.
Yummy.
By the end of this, you better be doing something horribly embarrassing.
We'll see. Yeah,
all of a sudden, it'll go from an audio podcast into video, and it'll just be like a video of Brandon without Jared without his top on dancing. Or both.
Or both. Hey, let's see where it goes, right?
Previous suggestion.
Have you guys seen Have you seen these apps for the iPhone for 100 push-ups?
No.
No. So this is like some new exercise craze with iPhone apps. There's like half a dozen of these and more every day. It's like you download this app. So you buy this app and it gets you set up with a routine where you gradually step up every day in the number of push-ups that you do. And the goal is within 6 weeks or 8 weeks to work your way up to doing 100 push-ups all at once. And supposedly the app will get you to that point. So I downloaded.
How many weeks?
Like 6 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. So I downloaded one of all my went on there, and one of my friends was telling me about it. So I went and found one that I thought looked pretty cool, and I'm about 5 days into it. My arms are so sore now. I'm doing about 50 push-ups a day right now.
Wow.
You don't do them all at once though. So it's not really, it's not like this most simplistic approach where you would just say, okay, on day one, you're going to do 5 and then you go up to 10.
Wax on, wax off.
Yeah, you actually, it's got cool down periods. So you stand up, stretch, that sort of thing. You get 2 minutes between and it steps you up during the exercise and then back down. So you'll start off at 5 and then go to 7, up to 12, back down to 9, you know, that sort of thing. And you,
interesting.
And it slowly builds every day. It's kind of cool.
You do one push-up 100 times a day.
Right.
No, that's cool. What's the name of the app?
Let's see.
The
exact one that I got is Push-Ups Pro. That's the one I bought. It looked like it had the best, while you're doing the push-ups, seemed like that was the important part to me, and it seemed like it had the best interactive part to that, where it gives you the cooldowns and all that.
And how much was it?
I think $2. It's not too bad.
Okay. Yeah. Right on.
So if you're looking for...
We will be expecting to have a video of you doing 100 push-ups. And now, what? How long have you been doing it? However long that is,
yeah,
you know, minus 6 weeks.
I'm a week into it. So, yeah, that'd be fun. We'll put a video up. But for those programmers or designers that are spending all day in front of a computer, here's a kind of a cool way to get yourself to exercise a little bit. And for me, it's a nice way to burn off all those beer calories.
I have huge arms and everything else is small.
I have a massive gut and huge arms. Yes. So speaking of beer, I actually started a beer podcast with one of my friends. He was over drinking with me a couple of weeks ago, and I showed him the whole podcast setup that I've got going here with a nice mic, and started talking to him about how he should do a beer podcast, and he was all for it. So now we do every other week a beer podcast on Thursday. It's just a little 30-minute deal. It's pretty informational. Just a little,
right?
Little
30 minutes.
He's actually right? he leads it, so it's his podcast. I let him totally go with it. And the guy, he's like clockwork with getting this thing down to 30 minutes. We do the little, yeah, because we do it in person, which is kind of a cool experience for me since we're doing this over Skype. You know, I don't get to see you guys during this, which is probably a good thing. But
yeah,
wait, I thought I was sat next to you whilst I'm recording this.
What?
Well, who's this then? I thought I was looking right at you.
So,
get the hell out of my house.
I'm only kidding.
So he actually comes over. We do some interviews. So we're hoping to get some people that are starting some breweries around here or running some successful breweries who he knows to come over. And we just sit around. Yeah. Yeah. That'd be awesome. That'd be totally.
Those guys rock. They totally would do it.
Yeah. It'd be great to go down there and just do it there. So, cause all we have to do is bring a laptop and this mic, and I mean, we'll travel. So, and he brings the beers over, and he's got the whole format of what we talk about, and it's all informational. It hasn't come out yet. I'll definitely let listeners know once it does get published. We only have 2 episodes done so far, and he's finalizing the artwork for the album, for the podcast album, that sort of thing. But you can catch him on Twitter at @nschultz. That's Schultz without the C. And let him know that you're expecting his podcast to be awesome. So he has some expectations to live up to.
Sweet.
Yeah. So have you had anything exciting happen since we last talked? Anything interesting?
My house caught on fire.
That's pretty interesting. Is that true? Or
you're just trying?
I bought some new shorts and glasses.
You know what? Actually, I did. I got a new part-time job.
Really?
Yes.
Doing what?
I am a dildo model. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Brandon Corbin. You can learn more about me at twitter.com/Brandon Corbin.
If you want to follow a dildo model, there's how you do it.
Boss, you just said that. Damn, it's a good job. It's not all over my Mac. The T, people. The T.
The T.
All right. Oh, dear.
I think we need to get into these articles before this goes completely off the rails. So we're starting off with the Windows 8 developer preview is up. This is posted by Nick Peelman. And
thanks.
Yes.
No, I was saying Nick. That's
sorry. Okay. Cool. We'll continue. So Microsoft's got their build conference going on this week, and they announced or released Windows 8 developer preview to much fanfare, a lot of excitement. I know Steven is super excited about this. It has the Metro UI built into Windows 8, so it's ready for tablet and other touchscreen devices. It has their whole Metro SDK that they're unveiling during this build conference. It's got all kinds of the new features that's in Windows 8, like the improved boot times and just all that awesomeness that is Windows. So, guys, did you go out and download the developer preview?
No.
I will be tonight.
Awesome.
So I always, every time Microsoft comes out with something, I always like to pretend that I like work at Microsoft and I imagine what the conversations happen to make the decisions that they do. And the whole Metro name. So I see them sitting there saying, well, we're building this interface that's going to be able to go kind of both ways. It's going to be able to go on PCs. It's going to be able to go on tablets. It's going to be, you know, we're going to try to port it over to the Xbox. And so we need a name that's kind of bisexual.
I knew that's where you were going.
Metrosexual was the first thing that said, I got it. And boom, there they go. Now we've got Metro everywhere, even though, you know, it's total cliche now.
Right.
I don't know what they're called.
Yeah, it is funny. That's the first thing I thought of, too. Was, you know, Metro is kind of a diss, something you call people. And it's kind of interesting that they're calling this whole thing the Metro style. And it's so ambiguous. Like, what does that – why Metro? I don't understand that.
Yeah.
Neither do I.
You know, honestly, though, I'm going to be honest here. I am excited to download this developer preview. I'm excited to install it, and I'm excited to start clicking around and playing with it. And I mean that without any sarcasm whatsoever. My whole stance is that I'm brand agnostic, right? I will like a moth to a light, I will gravitate to the best user experience and the thing that's going to allow me to be the most productive. Now, the chances are slim to none that this will be it. But hey, you know, maybe they pulled it off. Maybe this whole Metro thing, you know, can work for them. Again, my expectations are low, but all in all, I am kind of excited. I always like playing around with new operating systems, so we'll see. And most likely, I'll be let down and disappointed, and back to my normal ways.
Have you tried the tile interface on a Windows Phone 7?
Yeah, I've played around with it, right, but not enough to be able to make a judgment on the long term usability of it. Actually, Stephen and I were talking about that when you were in the restroom, and Stephen, your experience was, you know, your friend or who was it?
My brother.
Your brother.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
Well, yeah, he picked up a Windows Phone 7 phone. It was HTC, I think it was. Was it? I think it was, yeah. And to me, it just seemed like I didn't like it, and neither did he. Hence why he's back with an iPhone. He went. Had an iPhone. Then he got that to try it out, the Windows Phone 7, and then he went to Android, and then now he's back with the iPhone. But no, he didn't like it. It was just, I think it used to just, it was a confusing experience, like with an iPhone and even to a degree now with like Android, you know what you're doing with apps, you know where you are with the home screen and things like that. And Microsoft took this whole different approach, had, you know, this tile effect, and then you'd tap into those tiles and then it kind of followed the exact same UI as before, but there would be a few things that would be different. And it just seemed, I don't know. I didn't like it at all. So, you know, the user experience just wasn't there for me.
It seems with Windows 8, like they are, like, it seems like with OSs in general, so Mac OS and you've got Windows, and I don't know what Linux has on the touchscreen side, but it seems like this is a convergence point where you're going to have the user interface that's designed for touchscreen devices. Those elements are going to start to migrate into the main operating systems, and they're both converging towards this common point in the future where I could envision Mac OS and iOS converging. Obviously, with Windows 8, you've gotten Metro, the Windows Phone 7 OS, and Windows desktop operating system are now converged. This seems like the obvious place to go is to converge these things. Would you guys agree with that, or does that sound completely insane?
No, I definitely agree that, you know, at some point, I mean, hell, iOS and Mac OS X, you know, they're already, I mean, so eerily similar. It's, right. You know, I mean, it's there. Now, again, I don't know anything from an architecture standpoint about how the differences between the tablet or between the phone experience of Windows Phone 7 or whatever they call it. But yeah, I definitely think that's where people are going to go, because what's happening is these new design patterns that people are experiencing on the phone, that they're actually experiencing more on the phone than on their desktop. They start getting used to it. They start learning it. They start getting comfortable with it. So then it makes a lot of sense to just migrate that metaphor onto the desktop.
Right. And it's just the user interface at the end of the day. If it can run the apps regardless, because it's just a common operating system. That seems like an advantage. And so far, Mac is decidedly kept. They have the Mac App Store, and then they have the iOS App Store, and you can't run iOS apps on your Mac natively. Like, maybe there's ways you can do it, but this isn't a commonly, this isn't a standard feature. But I could see that there's no technical reason why that couldn't happen. They just haven't thought that that's an experience people would want, because, well, those are designed for touchscreen devices, those interfaces. So why would you really want to use your mouse? It would be like using a simulator when you're developing the iPhone app.
Yeah.
But that said, it seems like they're, you know, you can offer the option if people wanted to do it. If there's no other way for them to run that app, there's not an actual desktop version or the large format touchscreen version, then you can run it if you want. So I kind of like how in Windows, I don't know when Metro is available, if it's always available, and on my desktop computer I can bring Metro up or not. But it is kind of interesting to think that I could use those apps on my Windows 8 desktop as well.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at it from like a UI and UX point of view, it wouldn't make sense to have those apps running on a desktop. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I couldn't imagine. We were talking about this in like the in a Porsche made yesterday. Microsoft to developers, Metro is your future. And we had a discussion about, you know, how iOS could integrate with OS X as if it's on the same device. But then I couldn't see how the apps would work, you know, because if they're designed to that screen, to, you know, to the display of the iPhone or the iPad, you know, you're going to have elements stretched all across your screen, because they're going to be full screen apps, really, aren't they? Or,
right.
I don't know. I don't know how it would work.
You were talking about how Apple has a really interesting patent that let's say it's the iMac, and you could actually rotate the screen of the iMac back so it's more horizontal. Let's say it's a touchscreen interface in a future iMac, it would immediately switch to the touchscreen style, like the iOS style, and maybe the app that, you know, like how you have a universal app now that runs on an iPhone and an iPad. It'd be really sweet if it also had a desktop version to it, so the universal was truly universal. Yeah. And then depending on the orientation of your screen, it switches to the right sort of format. I really thought that sounded cool.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. That exactly, you know, all they'd need to do is then develop a third set of dimensions. My words weren't coming out then. But the thing is, though, there's all sorts of different desktop resolutions out there, and who knows what resolution you're running on. You know, for example, my iMac now has got a huge resolution, but someone with the same size iMac, they might have their resolution different. You know what I mean? So interesting.
What I would think is you would have the desktop version runs in as a windowed app, so it, you know, it's its own size and you can stretch it, and it has that's all of that Cocoa UE that Mac OS X has. It's using that, and then if you were to rotate the screen back, or you were to install that same thing on a tablet, on an iPad, then it's going to be specific to that device. And if it, let's say you rotate that iMac screen back, it might be good to have it be a fixed resolution. The second you rotate it back, it's not just adopting the resolution you had your desktop at. It moves it to a set resolution.
Yeah, that's definitely a good idea, yeah.
I'd like to see people using the Urban Spoon application on their iMac that is now turned, you know, vertically and for the shake feature.
There'd have to be an accelerometer in the iMac for it to register that it's a different angle, though, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, but hell, they can get those things for like 10 cents.
Especially when they come out with the 27-inch iMacs to make people shake those. That would be excellent.
No, I mean, it'd be really interesting to see, though, because you could probably maybe run a couple of apps side by side. It'd be really interesting to see that. I mean, I can imagine, could you imagine just a 27-inch iMac flat, and then it's like, you know, messing around with some apps on there. That'd be pretty sweet.
I have to give Microsoft kudos for coming up with this. I don't necessarily like the name Metro UE, but I like that they were so innovative with it. And there really wasn't anything that's tile-based. Everything else is icon-based, and this is tile-based. And I think they really came up with something kind of different here. It does have a lot of the same stuff, like the scroll bar in Metro looks just like scroll bars that iPhone and iOS popularized. but they did come up with a lot of their own stuff, and kudos to them for that.
Yeah, but I mean, they've done something different, but you know, everybody's used to icons, and it's like I was saying before, it's like, well, everybody's used to round wheels on their car, so I know this time we'll just put square wheels on, and there you go, everyone, Metro.
One of the things I thought when I first used an iPhone is I thought the weather app icon not updating to show the current temperature was just stupid to me. I didn't understand why I didn't do that. Because the calendar icon can do it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They can do it with the calendar icon. And obviously that's not an API that they open up to developers, I don't assume.
Right.
So yeah, that you know, I had that same kind of experience with it.
Well, take that one step further. And what if you had, if you have the square shape, a little bit larger sized area, you can put more information in there without people even having to enter the app. And I think that's one of the innovative things they did with Metro.
But also don't forget that one thing that Apple does is they restrict functionality for hardware performance. So True. If now I've got a tile that's, you know, an RSS feed that's hitting the server every, you know, 10 seconds, right. You know, then obviously. So again, it'll really just be interesting to see how this thing does in real world use, you know, as far as battery life and all that. I don't know, so I'm not going to say one way or the other.
Right. And they need good. They need good hardware, so they're only as good as their hardware partners.
Exactly.
All right. Did you guys have any more thoughts on this, or should we move on?
No, I'll talk all about it next week, though, because I definitely will be playing with it tomorrow.
Good, good. Yeah, I want to hear about that. Okay, our second article is Thoughts on Communicating Design. This is a article that it came out of a remark that this author made on Twitter regarding wireframes and just... This guy is questioning spending a lot of time doing wireframes, doing what are he's called personas. I'm not entirely clear what those are. He is saying that you should spend your time doing high-level design of, or if you have to define goals and roadmaps and that sort of thing, you should spend your time thinking through that, doing the problem solving, and then as briefly and clearly as you can, describe that to the customer. Talk to them about it. He says that the communication is the most important part. Trying to not spend too much time communicating, but so make yourself clear. But spend your time talking to them about well thought out stuff. So you go and think about it first instead of spending lots of time coming up with wireframes and all this other documentation, which is really just a means to an end, but never, that's not the end. You spent a lot of time doing things that aren't going to contribute. They aren't part of the final design. And so you can try to move quicker and spend your time doing the final stuff if you just communicate better and think through things sooner. That's kind of what he's talking about here. Did you guys get a chance to check this out?
Steven?
I'll hold my hand up, and I'm actually just brisk reading through it now, but I mean, it touches on a level that I agree with this guy, you know, with regards to, you know, not doing wireframing, just, you know, doing the design, because I think I mentioned last week about, you know, asking why, and obviously then you come up with the reasons, you know, as to why you do things in your designs, hence why you're able to communicate to other people why you've done what you've done. And obviously you don't really get that per se in the wireframing session prior to doing design.
Yeah, my take was that, you know, this guy had a hard time dealing with a lot of customers. And rightfully, again, I don't wireframe. You know, my whole take is I have a much better obviously not able to communicate right now. I'm able to communicate with the customer a lot more just when I present the whole thing. You know, when it's a wireframe, yes, they have to think abstractly. They have to, and so then they come up with all these weird shit things in their heads. but when you actually present a design to them, it's much clearer to them. They get it and they're like, oh, that's great, or oh, I hate that. And it makes the decisions process real easy. So yeah, I stopped doing that years ago because it opens up just Pandora's box when you start presenting these wireframes.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Plus, not only that, something you've done in a wireframe, then when you actually get it into making it into a design, it might not necessarily work.
Right.
Yep.
So, yep. And if
you and you've already got them to buy off on the wireframe, and now they're wondering why things changed, and you're spending time.
Exactly, yeah,
that's just a slippery slope.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not just that, you know, then it's a lot quicker. You know, okay, yeah, I don't like that button where it is, but if it's in the wireframe that they've already signed off, then it's going to be hard to kind of get rid of that button and so on. So, you know, I think you can curate the whole process better by not doing a wireframe, because then, you know, you're going to be making all the decisions before you put it to the client, and then they're just going to say, well, I like that, but maybe change the color to this, and so on and so on.
Right. So, another thing I've seen people do, designers do, is they'll come up with just a real rough design. This isn't the finished thing. This is just a draft, but I wanted to show it to you early to get your feedback and see if it's on the right track. And I would say that's a dangerous place to be too, because just like the wireframe, they're seeing something that's unfinished. And when they start pointing stuff out to you, like, well, I think this is missing like a cool drop shadow. And then you're having to explain, well, yeah, it would have the drop shadow in the final. This is just a quick, then you shouldn't have really gone through all of this. You should have just tried to bring this stuff to, you should really, when you work on the actual pixels, you should be working towards that final version. As soon as you're touching pixels, it should be, this is the final stuff that I'm working on right here. And then you show them it, and they say, just like you guys are saying, they can very clearly say whether they like it or not and what they do or don't like about it. And you can go back and change that. And you are already working on the final stuff, not something you're going to throw away.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I always design as if I'm going to be, as if I'm doing the final product, even if it takes me more time than, for example, say I'm billing for, I'm still going to do that because I believe in, obviously, in quality. And, you know, you want to push that across to the client, and you want to show them the best,
right,
the best version of what it could be. And then they don't have to imagine too much, like you just said, oh, with the drop shadow here, or it's going to have some sort of, you know, some letterpress text here and so on and so on. So, yeah.
Yeah. I've learned in my experience that clients have a terrible imagination. And if you leave anything up to their imagination, whatever they're seeing in their head is not what you're envisioning, you know, or not. If you showed another designer, they'd probably be on the same page with you. You show some client somewhere that's not a designer, and who knows what they're thinking in their head. So just don't let them imagine any of it. You got to really just lay it out there and spell it out for them. So,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So I had a domain name idea came up as you guys were having that conversation of pixelmolester.com. The damn thing's registered. It's registered. Who registers Pixel Molester?
What was going to go on Pixel Molester?
I don't know. You were talking about molesting pixels, basically, and you don't touch a pixel until this point, and right. Pixel Molester came to mind. Oh, damn it.
That would have been cool. Could have been an image editing, online image editing program or something.
I could have used that PixAss thing we're going to talk about in a little while for it.
PixAss-stick. Yes, we will get to
that. PixAss-stick.
With a stick.
Yeah. All right. And with that perfect segue, we'll move on to the next article. Currency.io, an example mobile web app built using web standards.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. So you load this up in your iPhone or iPod Touch. I'm not sure why it has to be one of those, but that's what
because
it
doesn't work in the iPad because they didn't make the little arrow that points down to the bookmark button function on it.
I'm sorry, iPhone and iPod Touch only then. Okay, no iPad. So it is an offline capable HTML5 currency converter app. It's not too exciting, but it's really meant to just be a demo, and they shared all the source on GitHub, so you can check out how they did it. And as soon as you load it up in one of those devices, you'll see this arrow that Brandon's talking about pointing down to your plus icon down there, so you can add it to your home screen. And then it just sits on your home screen as an app icon, just like any other app. And you can load it up, and it supposedly works offline. Although when I tested it today, it did not work offline for me, but it's supposed to.
I'm using it right now.
Does it work offline for you?
I'm just going to put on airplane mode.
Yeah, that's what I did. I put on airplane mode, and I went back, and it said, sorry, you're not connected or something.
Let's do it again.
This is a great It is. It's very boring. It's not very impressive. But if you're a, you know, someone who's comfortable with HTML and has been trying to figure out how I can develop something that's very iPhone specific, or this is a great way of doing it, where, you know, I could see Patrick, who's my designer, and I talk about him all the time, but at my full-time job, where this would be great for him, right? He's strong with JavaScript. He's strong with HTML and CSS, that he could then take this and start understanding, oh, here's what, you know, the viewport stuff is. Here's how to make it so when I do add this, that it launches without any Chrome around it. You know, things like that. So I think this is a really awesome thing for people who haven't ever considered developing, you know, a web app for the iPhone. And it combines it all instead of having to search Google for everything that you want to try to achieve.
Well, I'm using it now. I'm on airplane mode, so it's working offline. Oh. It's fine. It's really slick, actually. I like it.
I did something wrong, apparently, because it didn't work for me.
Well, I use Convert. What is it called? ConvertBot. So I'm going to be using that now. Okay. Currency.io. Yeah. There we go, guys.
Yeah.
And this is a Talentopoly live first number one. I'm using a currency app that I just found.
Nice. For all those times when you need to convert your currency.
You can. Yeah.
Does it have Bitcoin in there? That'd be sweet.
No, it's got Zynga currency though.
Interesting.
Jesus.
Wow. No, it doesn't.
It does not use Zepto, which is a WebKit specific JavaScript framework, and it doesn't use jQuery. It just uses raw JavaScript.
Yeah.
And it does target. Its targets are Android and iOS, although its page says only iOS right now.
Because iOS is awesome.
But if all you did was build this to work on an iOS app, you haven't accomplished that much. You've accomplished, yes, you can use web technologies, but why not make it cross-platform? I mean, I think it's a fail if you don't make it cross-platform.
I agree, but then, I don't know. The thing is I don't want there to be a slew of web apps, per se, because then you're not going to get this like specific experience like on... you know, when you're on an iPhone, and you're on a.
If Apple would open up their APIs to WebKit, they would.
Right. So if you could select photos,
they will not do it.
Select photos right there, biggest one.
Exactly.
Give us that, please.
You never know. There might be some certain things. Who knows? I mean,
you know, that was the plan in the beginning. When the iPhone first got announced, that was the plan. It was web apps only. There was no SDK.
Who needs apps on their phone? We have the entire internet at your hands. Right. Was the exact pitch. It was a brilliant pitch that Jobs gave.
Yeah, and it just fell on total silence.
Yeah.
Nobody was buying it. So, but Facebook believes that HTML5 mobile apps is where it's at, and they don't have an iPad app because Facebook doesn't want to build an app for every single device out there.
No, you know what Facebook doesn't want to do? They just don't want to. They hate continuity. They hate user experience. Listen. That's why.
That's the Talentopoly first. You heard it here first.
Yes,
yeah, Facebook. That's your title.
No, because you know why? Because Facebook, for example, why have Facebook only just now included the ability to include someone's name and then you can actually tap their name and go to their profile? It's like that's been on the site for I don't know how long, and it's just finally come out on the iPhone app.
Right.
You can even do it on their mobile app.
Yeah, they don't want to.
It's stupid. I just don't understand it. And they've still not sorted out the whole friends thing. Hi, I'm on my homepage, and now I click on friends. Sorry, do you want to add friends? No, I want to view my friends. No, you got to go to your profile to do that one.
I know exactly what you're talking about there. Anyway, that is annoying as shit.
End of rants, but yeah.
Yeah, no, that is totally annoying. There is a lot of weirdness, and they're changing their platform so quickly. But that's just it, is that they are used to moving at web speed. And when you do iOS development, especially, and maybe Android development, because there's not the approval process is a little bit better than this, but you don't move at web speed. You have to very deliberately put the features you want in there for the next month or so, and then you go ahead and submit that. You don't do changes every couple of hours or days or whenever you want. So they don't want to live in that world. They want to have a touch.facebook.com, which they have. They want it to work on every HTML5-capable mobile browser. And then they want to have their main Facebook.com UE. And those are the only two at the end of the day they really want to be supporting. So they have two versions of the interface that they have to figure out. They don't want to do iOS, Android, oh, and also have the iPad version and the universal binary and, you know, all the rest of that. So that's...
Dude, it's not hard, you know, to hire 2-3 more people to concentrate on the iPad app. Done.
Well, next. Like check-in. They're killing off the check-in feature. They said it was more of a test than a full feature, so they were experimenting with it, and it hasn't really gained the traction they wanted. So they removed it from the mobile app. It's still not out of Facebook.com yet, but they have to take it out. They have to submit that for approval, get that in there. Timing-wise, for these large companies, when they're doing these timed press releases and announcements, that having another company that is in the middle of that and controlling that for you, it can't be a good feeling. It's not where they want to be. So I can see this debate of whether the mobile web apps are better than native or native is better than, this isn't going away. This is going to continue to rage on. And as HTML5 capabilities get better built into WebKit and the other browsers, and as those mobile devices allow you through API hooks to do native type functionality, I think the mobile web app side is going to become much more powerful. And at the end of the day, the most inconvenient part in my mind is adding this thing to your home screen. Since you don't go to the app store, which is where everybody's trained to go, you have to click, you have to go to the URL, then click the plus thing on like the iPhone and then add it to that. Yes, that's going to cut down the conversion rate there. And they probably need to come up with a better way to do that. But at the end of the day, that's the biggest deficit I see. Once you get that currency converter on your phone, you shouldn't even think anymore about where you got it from. Is it native or not? It doesn't really matter at that point because it really is native.
Okay, so here's a talentopoly first, right? A web app store that has ratings that... Yeah, silence.
Dramatic.
No. Because it needs to happen. A web app store needs to happen without a doubt. And there's been a couple attempts at it, but no one's done a really, really good job of making it very easy to find apps to get them then onto your iPhone. Because again, adding those apps to your home screen is a little kludgy.
Yes.
But nonetheless, there is a huge ask market for it. And whoever does it first or whoever does it right could win huge because it's happening. It's going to happen.
I mean, you know who wants to do this?
Who?
Facebook.
And yeah.
No,
yeah.
I'm serious.
Totally. Well, yeah, the HTML5 app store.
Right. There's this thing, openappmkt.com was this, it's open HTML5 mobile web app market, just like you're talking about. And the guy who started it, he got hired by Facebook recently. And according to TechCrunch, Facebook has this thing called Project Spartan, where they are working feverishly to build an HTML5 mobile web app marketplace, and they want to populate it with apps and have it be this big open marketplace for finding apps and adding them. They even they have this JavaScript UE framework that they're developing called Bolt.js that is going to help people build these web apps and make it really easy to do.
Okay, so I've got 2 points. Well, the first one is like Apple, if you go on apple.com/web apps, there's kind of like a store of sorts for web apps that look cool on the iPhone. But then the second thing I wanted to say is there's a huge, huge problem actually thinking about if they had like a web app store, because then who's going to curate it and what are the limitations going to be? Because, you know, as you know, Apple's got a full team of people that check these apps for quality assurance.
Right.
And no, you'll need people. You'll need a crowd for sure.
Yep.
Yeah. Maybe if they did something, I don't know, it's going to have to be executed perfectly.
I totally agree, 100%.
Because otherwise it's going to end up like Android's marketplace, which is just all over the place.
Or worse, it could just look totally cheap. Like that app market that guy had made, it works, but it doesn't look that nice at all. It looks pretty cheesy, in my opinion. So I think it needs to, like, the experience of using the iOS app store is great. And it feels like you're using a great app store.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, we've burnt through 2/3 of the podcast already talking about 3 articles. So I'm
faster.
I'm going to put us into lightning mode now. This is the lightning round where we're going to go through the next seven or eight articles much quicker. Okay. So our next article, number four, CSS, taking control of the cascade. This is posted by Melanie Archer. And what they're doing, this is a post at 37 Signals. What they're talking about here is that CSS obviously has this cascading ability to it, where if you create a style at the body level, let's say, of font family, which is extremely common, and then lower down in your DOM somewhere, you say, well, this div with this class is going to have this font family. I'm sure you guys have seen this where you look in something like Firebug and you see all the crossed out styles below it of all the stuff you've overridden by, you know, specifically saying these are the styles on this element here. And it becomes what they call in this article an arms race, where you're basically trying to override all this stuff and make sure that you get everything overridden. Nothing kind of crept through this cascading style ability of CSS and screw you up. So they're talking about how they use Sass, and they have used Less as well. I know Brandon is a huge proponent of both of these technologies. And they use this to get very specific with their styles so that they can avoid that cascading ability of CSS, so they don't have to worry about it. And they actually have gotten to the point, I don't know how much I like this or not, but they actually show CSS written in Sass style here, in SCSS style, that matches the HTML markup. I mean, this is pretty verbose stuff, and it actually has the same nesting as the HTML does. So you could
look at... This is the first time that I've ever seen them side by side in that comparison where I go, okay, that makes some sense to me.
Okay, so you do like that.
I do. I like that it follows It still follows very closely to just what that nested structure is. With again, I always go back to the people who have to start learning HTML, and in this case, that makes sense to when I'm just starting out and I have no idea what the hell I'm doing.
Right.
That I can make sense of that.
Yeah, it's a lot.
That's all I've got to say.
Okay, it seems like to me, the only thing I will say is that I've definitely felt the pain of having to override those default global styles and making sure that I've gotten them all overridden. And there are times when I'm happy that CSS cascades, and there are other times that I'm cursing up a storm that it's cascading on me. So this might be something I want to try to get better at doing. It's on my list of things to play with.
Yeah, it's cool.
All right. Number five is if this, then that, put the internet to work for you. Brandon,
why? Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay. So there's very few times where, you know, oh, hey, this new app's coming out and everybody's talking about it on Twitter. That this is one that I actually hadn't heard about until Jared sent the, you know, Talonopoly podcast episode 8 show notes. And holy shit, this is very cool. So you guys can correct, it's if this, then that.
Which is
the domain name?
IF and then 3 T's. This might go down in history as the worst domain name ever.
Yes. But my God, it's a very cool product that you go and I can basically say, and so I set up a couple of them. I said, if somebody in Facebook tags a photo of me, then email it to me. And they've got, you know, 15 or 16 different kind of connectors that you can do, you know, Dropbox. They've got, you know, Instagram. I've got them all up here. I was just playing around with, Facebook pages, Gmail. I mean, just tons of stuff.
RSS.
Craigslist. It's amazing. It's very cool. Twitter, Tumblr, Evernote. And you just have all of these things and you can create these tasks. So, you know, one was if I tag a photo in Instagram with #DL, I want you to download it to Dropbox. And then I was kind of like, oh, well, I really know nothing about these guys. Do I want to give them access to my Dropbox? So then I kind of backed off and I said, no, I'm not going to do that one. But nonetheless, this is a very killer technology. It's brilliant because it gives people who are not technical the ability to start wrapping their mind around one of the most fundamental principles of programming. And I love it. This is killer. This was amazing. I'm so glad. The podcast, every amount of time I've ever spent is worth it because of this one application.
Steven, you actually posted this.
Yes.
So I'm dying to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, it's like I found this link on Twitter, and then I mean, like I said in the description, like put simply, like the service is like surreal, and it kind of echoes what Automator does on OS X.
Yep.
Like if you wanted to resize a folder full of 100 photos to a certain set of dimensions, you can use Automator to do that as opposed to opening Photoshop and doing all that stuff in there. So what this does is obviously, like Brandon touched upon, is like takes all the different various online tools, online services, Dropbox, you know, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and all them. And then you can create all these different type of tasks, which I think is just groundbreaking.
It's really cool.
It is just pure awesome.
To try making a task. Go onto this thing, sign up, and try making a task, and it will just hit you in the face how awesome this is as soon as you try to make your first task.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, for example, I did the example task that they've got there where you hook up Instagram and Dropbox. So any photo you take on Instagram gets saved to a folder on your Dropbox. And now that saves me having to sync my iPhone to, you know, basically get all my Instagram photos on iPhoto, because now they're just all on Dropbox. Yep. So now I've got this nice little thing on there. I think it's brilliant. And then their recipes section, right, is where people can create, for example, they might have found this totally awesome way to integrate two services that you'd never thought of. For example, here there's one right at the top, post shared items from Google Reader to Tumblr, right? Mm-hmm. So the recipes bit is the full social size of God, my words are not coming out right. Is the full social side to if this then that? So and you can create.
Yeah, all you have to do is click on one of the recipes, activate for both of the services, and it's just gonna work for you exactly how these people designed it.
Yeah, exactly, and it's that whole social element too, which I just think was absolute kick-ass. And then I sent an email to the team behind it, and obviously they've got a few exciting things coming up. And I did actually say I'd mention in this podcast as well, so that's okay. All good.
While you guys were talking, I just went through and I set up a for my uxjobs.org or Twitter account. Use this every day. At a certain time, I want you to tweet, hey, it's, and I can include the time. Have you, you hate your job? Go check out a new one, blue with a link. So any marketing people out there, this can be used to automate. I mean, they basically have a date time where you can trigger, you know, it's like cron. Yeah, this is killer. These guys did a beautiful job.
It's cron, it's cron for the web.
I think these guys haven't realized what kind of awesome they've just opened up. Because of all the different things you can do with this, especially because there's going to be more channels added over time, isn't there?
Sure.
So think about it. This is immense.
I think they know exactly what they're doing, because I think in this new modern world, the most people who have access to my Facebook, to my Twitter, to my Dropbox, to my WordPress, to my Tumblr, all of the OAuth stuff that happens, you know, whoever owns the most of them probably is the next big player.
Okay, we could talk about this all night. We're going to move on to the next article.
Oh, damn it.
Sorry.
Damn.
Article number six. MongoDB 2.0 released. Brandon's going to run down the features you should know about and care about in this new release in 60 seconds or less. Go.
I'm a noob, so you're going to have to forgive me, but this is a new release. Some of the big ones that come out are basically authentication across sharding. So if you have multiple instances running, that you can have a single authentication, which is good. Some of the cool ones is the geospatial. So it has it built in where you can do location-based searches. They now, opposed to just triangulation, they do polygon searches. Journaling enhancements this way. So when you have a nasty shutdown, that you don't have to constantly worry about that your data is going to be completely corrupt. So that's a great one. They've added a few additional regex options to querying, so you can do the dot notation and get a bunch of stuff back. And they've added an and operator. I assume that's this and that. It looks like it's pretty cool. And they're saying that it's an incremental production release, and it should work as a drop-in replacement to Mongo 1.8.
Brilliant. All right, our next article, number 7, when using IDs can be a pain in the class, posted by Harry Roberts. The gist of this is, and he uses the example of a Twitter widget, if you have a Twitter widget that has a specific style sheet that comes in with it, and you put it up in your header or in your footer, and you more than likely have a header ID set with a bunch of rules there. If you have any overlapping style sheets or style sheet rules there, that you're going to override the style of the widget, because the ID styles are going to override the class styles in the widget. And that's going to be a very nasty problem to deal with. So this really is another article in the same vein as many of the articles that have come out recently saying that using IDs in your CSS is bad. You should only use classes. And this guy is saying, take that with a grain of salt. Although this is one example that he can think of that's very real and a very good reason not to use IDs in your CSS. But he says that that doesn't mean you should ban the use of IDs completely, just that you should very carefully consider when to use IDs and when to use classes. Do you guys have any thoughts on this?
No.
Steven?
He was asleep.
It's beautiful.
Next. Boring article. Great. Okay. Yes. It's inherent to what we have to do with CSS. And hey, when all else fails, important.
Right. And if you're caught up right now in the debate of IDs versus classes and see that as a mutually exclusive thing, then maybe you should check this out. Otherwise, go about your business and happily use IDs and classes the way you've always been using them. I don't know.
You use classes to classify things generally. You use IDs to identify them identically. Or I specifically?
There you go. Uniquely.
Yeah, uniquely. There we go. There's the word I'm looking for. Oh, and by the way, triangulate and polygram searches. I have no idea what the hell that means.
It sounds amazing.
Thank you. And for every guy who's like so much smarter than me out there who's calling my bullshit, yes, that was complete bullshit.
I like it.
Anyway.
Okay. Number 8, eyeballs.js. Write MVC code on top of jQuery. Ooh, this actually got my attention. Because I've grown to love MVC. I like my models. I like having my validators in the models. And now I love my jQuery. You could do it twice. You could just
you have to do it twice. That's MVC awesome.
Everywhere. Or if you are building something that's mainly going to run in JavaScript, now you can do all that cool stuff in JavaScript, which I see with Node and with these other libraries. I see. JavaScript has kind of been sitting on the back burner, not getting the love in this respect. And now it's getting all these great libraries where you can do the business logic right in the JavaScript. And why have a real big, heavy server backend when you can do lots of it on the best server that's free? And that's your client, your client's browsers. Use up their CPU cycles, not your servers.
Yeah.
That's what I said.
Stupid name. I hate the how you call it, which is O_0.
Yes. So it looks like the Twitter avatar. That's what it reminds me of.
Yeah. So it's, I mean, again, there's a bunch of these kind of out here. It's cool if you really need to have it. Like if you're going to, like you just said, if you're going to be building a big front end heavy application, definitely look at something like this.
If you're building Gmail, if you're building the next Gmail, please do it using MVC or some nice pattern.
Yeah, because it's going to be a nightmare to manage. Nice. So this could do it. Now, the thing that's kind of weird is that it does come with what was it that I was looking at? Just like installing everything together, where it's now pulling in. I think you might have to be using the terminal app to generate some of the
it has generators
and all that.
This is very and it seems very Rails inspired.
Exactly. So I think that's one. Now, so I always go back and forth. Who's just going to be used more, the developer or the designer? Right. And in this case, I think that it's probably going to be more of the developer who would leverage this.
Yeah, they actually have generate scaffold, and the syntax is exactly Rails generator style. But that could be cool. Although it seems like Rails is pretty set on, CoffeeScript is mainly a syntactical difference, but since they've recently adopted CoffeeScript, I'm not sure that they would really be looking to bring something like this natively into it, but it's there if you want to use it. So,
oh, snap.
Yeah.
My Chrome, every damn tab in Chrome just crashed on me.
Oh my God. How is that even possible?
I don't know.
Oh, that's stupid. Oh snap. Hi.
Wow. No.
Get all lost. Right. Seriously. Chrome.
While Brandon's reloading all of his tabs, we're going to move on to the next article. Identifying conflicts in a UI design. And this is another 37 Signals employee writing this great blog post. He is talking about the three areas of conflict that he looks for when he's evaluating their user interfaces. The first conflict is the domain. He says the domain is the encyclopedia of knowledge that all of your users have. So when you're using terms like booking, reservation, or customer, what does that mean to the user? Are you using those terms correctly? The second area of conflict is between the pixels on screen and the user's eyes and brain. So he's saying here that you've got to make sure that the spatial relations work. The way that users scan the screen, you need to design the UI to conform to that. You need to use color to signal the right type of thing. So red buttons are easier to spot. Tiny gray footnote buttons, you know, obviously are in the background. So use that as to build your hierarchy of importance. And the third area of conflict is the implementation. So it's nice to see he actually gives some thought to giant high-res background images, which may look great, but are going to take a long time to load and create a bad experience there. So he is looking at some of the implementation effects that your choices may have and taking all of this together and trying to help them shape really great user interfaces. So what are your thoughts?
Two thumbs up.
You like it?
Yeah. So
these are things you should be looking at in your user interface designs.
You already used up the 60 seconds on that article.
Sorry. All right, we'll move on.
It's a good article. Check it out. I'm sure, Steven, I'm sure you have a ton of opinions on this.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, we are running out of time, unfortunately.
True.
But,
and the next one is the next one is much, much more exciting. So let's get to the next article.
But wait, before we do, definitely read this article, Identifying Conflicts in a UI Design, because it is great. Awesome.
Number 10, this is one I know all three of us are super excited about. It's called Gimme Bar. It's a whole lot more than bookmarks. Steven, why don't you take it away with this and tell us what it's all about?
It's a bookmarking site. Thanks. I'm kidding. No. Okay. So Gimme Bar is it's this brilliant way to kind of It is you create bookmarks whether it's you know, you grab a full website, it makes an image of that, saves it as a bookmark, or you can grab images into that bookmark there.
Yeah, it's kind of, well, the way you described it before we started the podcast, I thought it was great. So you said it's like Dribbble, but it's for everybody, and you don't have to, it's not about your own work. If you find a website that looks fantastic, then you use Gimme Bar to take a snapshot of that and share it with everybody, and you have this amazing collection of all these great-looking websites and great-looking stuff that you're finding that other people can come and like, they can retweet it, they can interact with it. Would you say that's a pretty fair description of it?
Yeah, my description kind of messed up because something went wrong with Skype, and I didn't know what was happening, whether you guys could hear me or not. But so you can add websites to it, and it creates an image of that. You can add images from or bits of text, or like, for example, a URL of a tweet or things like that. And it all adds it into this collection, and you can have as many collections as you want. And the best thing about this is, because it hooks into Twitter, to grab people who've already signed up, you know, so you can find your friends on there. You can actually view what their collections are and what's, you know, what they found that inspires them or what they like.
Right.
And I think that is super useful because, you know, you might have your own opinions or that, you know, that site looks great or the way this room's laid out looks awesome or this photo's really cool. And then somebody who you know is knowledgeable in the industry or you follow on Twitter or what have you, or someone who inspires you, and then, you know, you would then be interested to see, you know, what inspires them. For example, say Steve Jobs signed up to this. Everybody would want to know what inspires him and so on and so forth. And this is really awesome, and I think it's just a super, super unique, utility tool service. So right now it is just invite only. So, you fill in your information and then you get given an invite within an hour or maybe 2 hours. So definitely awesome.
It looks great.
The design is
real simple and looks fantastic. Yeah,
I don't think our description is doing it as justice. Basically, watch the video on gimmebar.com. That's GIMMEBAR.com. Just watch the introduction video. It explains it a whole lot more. And then start using it when you get your invite, and honestly, you will see the value in this. It's pure awesome. I mean, I use something that's, for example, an app that's called Little Snapper, where I collate all my screenshots and stuff and have it hooked up to Dropbox. But I'll soon be dropping that in favor for this because, like I said, I can view other people's stuff. That's great. So, for example, when we're collating on a project together, you might like these designs and then you want to share that with me. And then you've got this full little scrapbook there. And the best thing about it is you can also save this stuff to your Dropbox as well. So images that you like, websites that you found that Gimme Bars just made into a PNG, you know, an image file. Seriously, awesome. I wish I had more time to talk about it, but...
Yeah, well, once you've had a week to play with it, we should definitely follow up on it next week.
Yeah, definitely. Stick in the warm-up discussion.
And all of the top designers seem to be on it, too. So it's really neat that you can find them on it and follow what they're finding inspirational.
Yeah, definitely. It is. It is awesome. Like I said, watch the video. It explains it perfectly. Just be patient when you get you've filled in the details to get your invite, and you will have it within a few hours. And just check it out. I mean, actually, during the recording of this podcast, we actually had a comment from somebody on the actual article, and they think it looks good, so it's all good.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we are at our final article here, number 11. I wanted to get this in because I think it's really cool. It's called Pixastic, which I think is a terrible name.
Pixastic.
I hate saying it. But it is a JavaScript image processing library. It's posted by Marcos Zanona. Sorry if I mispronounced that.
Who is he, Brandon?
Who is he? I don't know.
He's been a big user on Talentopoly for a while now. Marcos is awesome. He's been posting lots of great stuff.
Oh no! Thank you, Marco.
No, yes. I thought you were talking about the guy who made Pixastic.
No, that's Jacob.
Yeah, oh. Jacob. Good old Jacob.
Sealed.
Who we do not know.
Yeah, we don't know him.
Never mind.
Here's why I think this is cool. And the copyright on it, by the way, is 2008 to 2009. I don't know if that means that this is a older website that hasn't been updated recently or what's going on there. But I think even if this is older code, this is really useful now because you have, going back to our HTML5 mobile web app discussion, you have these mobile web apps that need image editing capability in JavaScript. And here is a library that will let you do that. You can do filters, you can crop, you can do all this cool stuff using this library.
Brandon. Adobe, get on board.
Brandon, yeah, no, I love this. I think this really is. Now, what's interesting is it's using Canvas. And so I've never really played around with Canvas too much. So I don't know how easy it is to get the image data out once you apply all these filters. And that will kind of be an important piece of it. But it really does look like if you're thinking about building, an HTML5 image editor with stylizing effects, I mean, hell, you could probably take this and build something similar to like an Instagram where you could come up with your own filters and you apply all of this stuff and it's all done in JavaScript. So it's a really, really cool technology. Now, again, it's using Canvas. You can't just like right click and grab the image and have it be there. It's really cool. It's got all the different effects that you'd expect, like in Photoshop, where you've got saturation, you've got blur, you've got pointillize, you've got sharpen. I mean, it's got all glow. I mean, it's got tons of different features that are available. And I don't know what the license is. Do we know what the license
is? Yes, I actually looked at that. It was, let's see here, it was like MLP. It wasn't a very restrictive license. It's on the download page. Yeah. MPL. It's the MPL license.
Don't let the website fool you because the website is ugly. I mean, he's definitely more of a developer than a designer. Yeah, it has only really been tested extensively on Windows, so that might tell us another thing. I assume it works on the Mac is what he says.
The MPL,
but very cool stuff. Check it out.
MPL, by the way, is the Mozilla public license, so I think it's fairly non-restrictive.
This is pretty old because in this post that he's talking about browser capability, saying right now it only works in Firefox.
2+.
So it's definitely an older post, but my God, it's got a lot of cool features in it and someone could do some really neat stuff with it.
I think it might have been ahead of its time.
Yep.
All right. Well, we're going to end it there. Thanks for listening. If you've made it this far, you rock. Send a tweet to Talentopoly and let us know you made it to the end of the podcast. We love to hear that. If you use Instacast or iTunes, don't forget to subscribe. We'd love to outrank that 8ify podcast. And thanks
for listening. That's the number 8ify.com.
You've been listening to the Talentopoly podcast episode 8. Thank you.
When you cry, you put your tears in a glass, and I will feed them to my neighbor, Chitmot Kalyaptepnov.